Hello and welcome to Everyday Law, the show that demystifies the law for you and your family. I'm your host, Robert Monahan, and thanks for tuning in. The tentacles of the law are many, and they touch on things like bankruptcy and home repairs gone awry. And that's our topic tonight, home repairs gone awry. So let's get right to it. Hello and welcome to Everyday Law. I'm your host, Robert Monahan, and we're here broadcasting from the studio of WRLR 98.3. I'm here tonight with my friend Mark Van Donselaar, and tonight we're going to be talking about home repairs gone awry. Now, I was going to ask you about home repairs gone awry.
Right, yes.
And that's what we're talking about tonight. And last time when I talked about bankruptcy with my guest, and I told her that people often come to see me with a little bit of embarrassment. They feel like – I'm a personal injury lawyer, and they feel like, oh, I never thought I'd be seeing someone like you, you know, in my life. And I'm not sure if it's embarrassment as much as they feel like bringing a personal injury action isn't something a good person would do. I'm not sure where they get that idea, although I think it's the insurance companies.
I think so, too. It's those Allstate ads dissuade people,
right,
maybe.
Right. You're really not in good hands, people, with Allstate. But anyway, and they're not good neighbors if you're in an accident. But anyway, by the by, when people come to see you about home repairs gone bad, and just so you know out there, listeners, we're going to be talking about two aspects of home repairs gone awry. Right, we're going to be talking about the perspective of the homeowner and what they should do before the job, during the job, and after the job. And we're also going to be talking about the perspective of the contractor.
Yes, the person doing the work.
Doing the work, right. What he should be thinking about before the job, during the job, and after the job.
Right.
And whereas people come to see me with a little bit of embarrassment usually, do people come to see you with a lot of anger? How do people approach it, and then how do you handle their emotions when they see you?
Well, certainly everyone approaches it differently. But the typical homeowner who has had a problem with a construction project, I think typically they're angry, as you said.
A homeowner will be angry, right?
A homeowner will be angry, will be frustrated, and sometimes, depending on circumstances, they'll really be hurt. There's a lot of potential for hurt feelings. And I think the reason for that last one, for the hurt feelings, is, you know, when you have a project going on, you develop a relationship with someone and there's some trust built up. And then when you have problems on that project, all that trust comes crumbling down.
That's interesting.
And your relationship feels like, oh, I thought I had this great relationship. Turns out it really wasn't. And so that's where some of the, you know, they almost feel as though their trust has been violated by this person. And it certainly wasn't intentional or anything, but they have that feeling. But as you say, frustration is also a very real emotion that people feel. And then just anger.
You know?
These are people who have had work done at their house. And we all love our houses. We all want to have nice houses. And when something goes wrong with it, that's a very emotional ordeal.
They're like, oh my gosh, do I have to live with this faucet that I can't turn on and off the way I like, or a driveway that hasn't been laid the way I intended, or whatever it may be?
Absolutely.
They're like, do I have to live with this for the rest of my life?
Absolutely. And then there's the financial aspect. Do I have to live with it is your question. And the answer really is, well, can I afford to fix it?
Do I have to pay this guy?
Do I have to pay to fix it?
He screwed things up.
Right.
Now, when people are angry, what's your approach to – do you my approach when people feel a little bit of hesitation to see me is to reassure them that, hey, I will handle this problem for you. It's difficult to deal with insurance companies. The whole process is intimidating, and you don't do this usually, so I'm here to help. Is that your take on it?
Yeah, I really try and look at it as first identifying what the problem is, and then what are the viable options to fix that. So if you have a repair project going on and it's only half completed – and they want to get rid of someone, for say, who's been doing the work, then they need to have a discussion with me or with someone about what's going to happen next. How do they get their project done in a way that's going to make them happy? And there might be you know, 3, 4, 5 different ways to do it, you have to assess those and figure out your best options.
And the real difficult thing, I think, about people coming to see you, homeowners coming to see you after a project has taken a turn for the worse, is they didn't have you involved from the start.
Well, that's very true.
Right?
Right.
Like for me, usually I get them at the beginning of the process. And if they've taken steps on their own without me, like would usually be the case in a home repair case, it can be a real problem.
Oh, very much so. That's, you know, spot on right there, because so many problems could be solved, could be prevented if at the outset things were done differently.
And let's talk about that. We were going to talk about what a homeowner should do before a job starts.
Right.
And one question I had is, do you have any advice for homeowners out there about how to even find a reputable contractor?
Well, I think the best way to find someone to do business with is really to ask your friends, ask your neighbors.
References.
References from people that you know and trust. Is really your best source, I believe. Now, of course, you can go to various lists. You can go to Angie's List. You can look at the Better Business Bureau.
Does Craigslist have something? I've never used it, though.
You can go to Craigslist, but I don't really advise it.
What about the lists at hardware stores like Home Depot or Menards? Have you ever heard of people using those?
I've heard of
people using them, but then they come to me with problems.
Okay. I have not heard of people using, say, a tradesperson recommended by a store, but
I think that they're not really recommended, but they can put their name in as a person that the store can give out.
Yeah,
but it's not a reference, really.
And it could very well be a friend of a store employee who says, hey, friend, you work at Home Depot. I'm a plumber, for example. If you happen to run into people wandering around Home Depot who need plumbing help, why don't you drop my name?
Yeah.
I would bet that's how that happens.
Yeah.
And that, to me, it's a reference of sorts, but it's not the best one in my mind.
And then when your friends recommend someone, would you recommend – I mean, I've met people – that have dropped $20,000 or more on a job, a significant investment in a home repair, and they didn't do things like ask the guy for other people that he's worked with that they could call and so on.
Right.
Is that something they should do? I mean, I know it's a little uncomfortable, but I think if you're going to make a significant investment, like more than $5,000, even $5,000, I would think you would want to talk to someone he's worked with before.
That's definitely accurate. Maybe it is a little bit awkward to say to someone, hey,
let's see some ID.
Let's
see some references.
Right.
Yeah, right.
Where have you done work?
Who would vouch for your character? Yeah.
But you're absolutely right. If you're doing a home remodeling or repair job, you're sprucing up a kitchen, you're redoing a bathroom, you know, maybe finishing a basement, you're looking at a really significant investment. And it really is an investment, folks. It's not just, you know, parting with money. This is an investment. You want to make a return on it. You want to get something for the money you're putting in. And so you really should treat it like an investment and look at it very seriously. Because there's definitely perils along the way.
Oh yeah.
If it's not done right, unfortunately, there's a lot of pitfalls along the way.
There are unscrupulous contractors out there, and I think there are more than there used to be because construction work has been down since the recession.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. And you know, some of those people are out of the business, but there's still people who are holding on. Another thing that I know contractors face is there's very thin margins.
Because competition is so fierce?
Competition is fierce. It's hard to get a new job for someone. And so they take on projects that maybe they shouldn't, or they put out bids that are lower than they should be. And all those sort of things lead to problems, or potentially lead to problems down the road.
Yeah, yeah. Now, what about the down payment? I've heard people put down just huge sums for down payments.
Right.
And that makes me so uncomfortable when you hear that, because they say not only has the job gone bad and they did terrible work, but we're out $25,000. I tell them that generally the down payment is to pay for materials only. Is that right?
And I think that's good, solid advice. Certainly some down payment is going to be required for any construction project. It's completely logical, and there's nothing about that to be worried. But if there's a situation where you're paying more than 50% down, that, to me, would raise a red flag. I have seen numerous situations where a project is going on and the contractor doing the construction has received all the money that he's planning to get on the job.
Already,
yeah. Before the job is finished.
Right.
And guess what?
He doesn't finish the job.
No, he doesn't.
No, he walks off.
Because he has everything that he's going to get. There's no motivation to finish. And unfortunately, he's gone, likely never to be seen or heard from again. So you want to be really careful with that. You don't want to disincentivize the contractor by giving him all his money up front.
Right,
so
right.
What I would do is, if you have a $20,000 project, let's say, you're going to be required to put something down. But then future payments should track roughly the progress on the job.
That's interesting, yeah.
So if he's 60% done with the job, then it'd be fair to pay him 60%, I'd say. But if he's only 30% done, then don't pay him 60%, because then you see you're out of balance.
Right. Do contractors ever put money in escrow saying, we're saving this for your materials? I've run into a couple that was very angry at their contractor because they felt that he used what they paid him for materials for another job.
And oh, yes.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, that's the classic robbing Peter
to pay Paul
situation.
Yeah, right. Thanks for the money for the materials. I use that to pay for the materials on another job, and
exactly.
I use the money that's coming from you in the future to buy your materials. And it sounded terrible.
And it is. And that's not the way it's supposed to work. I think, unfortunately, in the real world, it happens all the time.
I think it does, too.
You asked about escrowing funds.
Yeah.
I don't know of a contractor that
either.
Does that.
I don't think they do. Yeah.
Maybe if you're doing a bigger job, but you're talking about a much larger job, much higher dollar figure before something like that would come into play. Your standard repair, remodeling contract, that's just not going to happen.
Yeah. And then the elderly, I think, are especially vulnerable because they can't take care of their property anymore. They may be getting up there in age and getting frail, and a charming contractor can talk them out of a lot of money and do a poor job, and they don't know what to do then.
Well, that's absolutely right. Anyone who is less savvy, I will say, is capable of being taken care of. And
yeah.
You're absolutely right. If you have a contractor making a sales pitch to a person, and that person falls for all the bells and whistles that are presented to them, there's a significant chance there that they could be taken advantage of.
Do you ever take cases to the state's attorney's office for elder abuse or anything like that when you have an elderly client that's really been taken to the cleaners by a shady contractor? Because I've done that before.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
That's not actually something I've done, but it sounds like a really good idea, actually. Do you know how it went with that instance?
You start with a complaint to the police, and then you take it to the state's attorney's. We went to the sheriff's office because it was an unincorporated area of Lake County. And we went to the sheriff's office to make a complaint. And generally, I think I've done it twice, they told us it was a civil matter.
Oh, well, then the sheriff wasn't interested.
They weren't. And it doesn't even get to the state's attorney's office till the local police or sheriff take it there.
Oh,
they're the gatekeeper.
Oh,
they're the
I
gatekeeper.
See. Well, that's kind of unfortunate because it is a civil matter. They're right about that.
It's their way of – I thought – I was pretty frustrated that they wouldn't start a criminal investigation, but they were like, it's a contract. It's a civil matter. It's not a criminal matter. And I think I even had a statute that said if an elderly person pays out a certain dollar figure, there's a certain statute about elder abuse, and I thought my case fit within the statute. But again, they were like, you're the lawyer. you help her get the money back. And I think that the contract was long gone.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's unfortunate, but it's a good idea. It'd be interesting to try and get that in front of a state's attorney and
Someday.
See if they do something with
it. Yeah, I hope that never happens. I hope that, I mean, it's a terrible situation. But
right. You like to think that it's never necessary, but the reality is it probably is necessary,
right,
actually.
Right. And, you know, I think the elderly are especially vulnerable. And then there are certain contractors that are out there chasing down jobs.
Yes.
Have you ever heard of storm chasers?
We've all encountered the storm chaser and the guy who canvasses a neighborhood who goes door to door.
It's been rainy lately with hail maybe, and you can get a new roof.
Right. Those people I would always watch out for. I just had a client recently actually because we had some storm damage this summer, right in this area.
In Grays Lake. Terrible storm damage. Tornado.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
There was some serious damage to the high school and the neighborhood around it.
Absolutely.
In other areas, too.
And, of course, those repairs need to get taken care of. A contractor needs to do those. I had a client who didn't have severe damage but was, I'll say, solicited by a contractor. And unbeknownst really to my client, before they knew it, they had entered a contract to have all kinds of work done at their house.
Right, right.
And their belief was that they were just talking about estimates and proposals.
But they had signed away their rights. They had signed a paper that allowed the contractor to talk to their insurance company for them and negotiate with the insurance company to talk about the job.
Yes.
That is terrible.
It is.
And Mark, we have to take a break. But when we come back, can we talk a little bit more about storm chasers?
Absolutely.
And then I want to talk a little bit more about what we should do, but what a homeowner should do before entering into a job with a contractor, okay?
Absolutely. Sounds good.
I'm your host, Robert Monahan, and I want to thank you for listening in to Everyday Law. You can reach me anytime on my phone number at 847-848-6165, or please visit me at my website at monahanfirm.com. That's www.monahanfirm.com. And finally, if you'd like to subscribe to our newsletter, please text the word Everyday Law, one word, to 22828. That's 22828. Now we're back to the show. Thanks for listening. Hi, you're back listening to Everyday Law with Bob Monahan, and I'm here with my guest Mark Van Donselaar, and we've been talking about home repairs gone awry. And we were talking about the issue of storm chasers, and I think everybody knows what a storm chaser is, right? I mean, we described it a little bit.
Yeah, I think everyone knows. I mean, you have a destructive storm in your neighborhood, in your town, and soon enough you see more pickup trucks driving around with names you've never seen on or you've never heard before.
Right. And they're not from the neighborhood.
And they're not from the neighborhood. They're not from the area. It's likely that they're from out of town trying to scoop up some sales or trying to scoop up some jobs. And you see these guys, they do roofs, they do siding, windows, the whole gambit.
And they have you sign a paper and you don't read it and you don't know what it is, but that paper gives them the authority to start negotiating with your insurance company over the job.
Well, and it
does. Is that right?
Well, I think that is right, but it goes even further than that, really, because what it is, and here's what they'll tell you. They will tell you, oh, this is just something for us to try to have a proposal. This gives us the right, like you said, Bob, to talk to your insurance carrier and to figure out whether you have coverage for whatever damage it is that you've suffered. But if you read the contract closely, and that's the key, it really is a contract.
Right.
It is binding on both sides. If you read it closely, what it also says is that if the coverage from the insurance company is approved, then they have a right to do the work.
Right.
And, you know, you might not mind them talking to your insurance carrier and doing some of that legwork, but that might not be the company who you want to actually do the work.
And then it's too late.
But by that point, it really is too late. They have an enforceable contract. Now, I was telling you about the situation I had with a client. We were able to get them out of the contract based on, I'm going to say, some technicalities. I think there were some terms that were missing from the contract that arguably made it not a contract.
Interesting.
And so we were able to send a couple letters, have some conversations, and I think we made it clear to the storm chaser that this was not a job that they really wanted to do. We weren't going to be ideal customers for them. And so they went on their way. But once you sign that paperwork, you really are locked in. And so you want to be real careful with that. And you just generally want to be really careful whenever anyone comes to the door soliciting any sort of remodeling work or construction work. You know, your radar should go up as soon as that happens.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I agree with that. Now, another thing that I wanted to talk about was now, is there anything else you wanted to say about storm chasers? Because there was a couple things that I had in mind, but they've slipped my mind right now, and I can't remember what I was going to say. It happens.
I think that covers it.
I'm getting older.
I think that covers it. I think we were going to talk about contracts, though.
Yeah.
I touched on it a little bit with the storm chasers.
I think we were going to say that the way a homeowner can protect himself is to have certain things in the contract from the very get-go with the home repair guy, with the contractor.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, I think a homeowner can save all sorts of problems down the road by having a clear contract that has all the terms in it that everyone wants. And that just solves a myriad of problems, I think. So, you know, there's some really basic stuff that I think people just forget maybe in the moment and never gets put in a contract. For instance, I can't tell you how many times I've heard that a person was promised for a job to be done within a certain amount of time.
A completion date.
But it seems also just as often that that completion date is never in the contract. And so what you hear from the upset homeowner is, well, this job was supposed to be done within 6 weeks. And I say, okay, I'm looking at your contract. That's not in here. And so we really can't hold the contractor to that date because you have a contract. And that term is not in it.
It's very interesting. I think that people tend to get in these things themselves, and you know they get into like the tune of $20,000-$25,000 sometimes without spending the $500 it might take to have a lawyer either look at the contract that's been presented to them and see that it has everything it needs to have, or draft a contract up themselves with a lawyer.
Yeah, absolutely. Because like I say, there's no better way to prevent future problems than to have a good contract. The other thing I would say related to what should be in a contract is simply everything should be in a contract. And the reason I put it that way is often, too, I've seen situations where people claim to have side deals. And so, for instance, the contract that is actually written up is for $10,000 and is going to include remodeling, let's say, one room. But then when you start talking to them about the project, they say, well, you know, he was supposed to do all these other things for me too. And he told me he was going to put that in, that was going to be part of the job, and he wasn't going to charge me anything for it. And again, you're faced with a situation where that's just not going to be enforceable. It's not written down, and so we could never go to court if we needed to and enforce that. It is completely unenforceable.
Is the parole evidence rule a rule of evidence or a rule of contract? I remember learning about it, but I can't remember which it was. I think it's a contract.
I think
we learned about it in contracts class in law school.
Yeah, right? Definitely.
And the parole evidence rule says that oral modifications are not evidence, right? Or that
correct.
They can't be presented in a contract case.
And a lot of times you'll have a contract that says in the fine print somewhere that this contract, what that means then is the writing that you is the entire contract.
Right.
So
right.
By its very terms, it says there's nothing else.
And no oral modifications are admissible to change the contract unless they're written down and if officially made part of the contract. Right.
But guess what? That never happens.
Never happens. Never happens. Yeah. So completion date is an important thing. Getting the scope of the project into the contract.
Yeah, absolutely. And that goes with what I just said. There should be no side deals. If work is going to be included, then write it down, would be what I have to say. And certainly, you know, if you're planning on work to be done, then everyone should be okay with putting that down in writing and signing off that, yes, this is the scope of the work.
What do you think holds homeowners back from doing that? Do they? Is it because the contractor comes with a proposal that acts as the contract and they don't say, let me review this with my lawyer? Because no one would think of that, I don't think.
Yeah, I think that is what happens. What happens is the contractor or the person doing the work will typically have a form proposal. And he'll write down on there what it's going to be that he's going to do. He'll maybe have various line items. He may include certain plans or specifications. You know, the detail level on those will really depend upon the size of the job.
Right.
But so the contractor will really be in charge as the contract's created. The homeowner gets it. They certainly have a chance to review it, but whether they do or not really is anyone's guess. A lot of times they're really looking forward to the project. It almost becomes an emotional issue. They want to get to it right away, and they don't pause to make sure that it's done right.
Yeah.
And a little pause there, consulting an attorney there, paying to have an attorney to look at a contract, really could save a lot of headaches.
And people are willing to put down to a contractor that they don't really know, with a contract they don't really review or understand, $20,000 to $25,000. I keep coming back to that number because I have a family friend that hired a contractor and paid them up front $20,000 to $25,000 and just left the job and almost held them hostage with their own home.
Right,
because he was holding so much of their money.
And my take on it is, if you're going to invest, and again, it's an investment, if you're going to invest that money into a remodel of your house, whatever phase it is, I say it's worth another $500 to sit down with your attorney and to say, look, here's what I have as a contract. How does this work for me? And the attorney will have questions. You know, he'll help you or she'll help you identify what you think the scope is, make sure that the contract covers that, make sure that you think about issues such as a completion date, issues such as the payment schedule. All those things are really important, and they can easily be overlooked.
It's not intuitive. It's
no,
not
right.
It's not
absolutely
something you just know, oh, I'm a man, I've been around the block, I know these things. No, it's not intuitive.
No, not at all.
People know these things, right?
It's not at all, and it really is. I really do believe it's emotional. People want to get to this because they're excited, and rightfully so. You know?
We're going to get the kitchen we've always wanted.
Absolutely.
Finally, the bathroom faucet's going to be fixed, whatever it may be, right?
Absolutely. People have that idea, and when they can put together
the dream come true.
And do it really
that
is.
That leaky faucet's been on my mind for
right.
months,
you know,
and months, and now we're going to get it fixed. Yeah.
It could be much longer. It could be. I've hated this kitchen for 5 years, and I finally get to see it torn
you
out.
You promised me when we moved in this house that we'd remodel this kitchen.
Right. We've all made those promises.
It's time finally to do it. Okay, so that's basically the before period in a contract job. From the homeowner's perspective, they should get references. They
yes.
should talk to the friends or the people that the contractor has worked with before. They should pay only a reasonable down payment. And if the contractor is asking for something unreasonable, it's a real red flag. I mean, a serious red flag. Be wary of storm chasers. We didn't talk about this one, using a friend for a job, right? I mean, that's something that you should be careful about too.
Yeah, I always cringe a little bit, and I get these phone calls, you know, not daily, but maybe weekly or definitely monthly, where someone will call up and say, well, I have a problem with my remodeling job. And I say, okay, well, what is the problem? Tell me where you're at. And, you know, they'll go into the explanation. They can, you know, most people are pretty good at explaining what it is. And I say, well, who's doing the work? And you would not believe the number of times where they say, oh, it's an old buddy of mine.
Yeah.
I've known this guy for 15 years.
My girlfriend's father. Whatever.
That was one of the best examples
right,
I've
right, right.
Or I've heard this before. My girlfriend's father, or my daughter's, how did it go? My daughter's boyfriend's husband. And he was begging me for a job because he hadn't worked in a while.
Right, right, right.
And, you know.
And then none of the formalities are followed. Forget getting a lawyer review when it's a friend of the family doing the work.
Right? Absolutely. Not, then no, all formality is out
happen.
The window.
Right, right.
I mean, you're almost just giving away money.
It's like a misunderstanding is bound to happen under those circumstances between both of you.
Absolutely. And that's not to say that friends can't do jobs together, but it creates an other layer that could really make things tricky.
Because, oh, yeah.
Because you won't be as firm with your friend.
Right.
And you won't be as careful about your own interests when you're dealing with a friend.
Because you have a level of trust, so you think.
Absolutely.
But it's a business transaction.
Absolutely. It is a business
transaction. It's a contract of sorts, and you know, you've got to fill your end. You're paying the guy to do work, and he's got to do... I think it's a real problem to use any kind of friend to do a job.
It definitely concerns me, and... If, you know, the proof is just in the number of times I hear the story. And, you know, that's kind of my take on it. I like the idea of employing friends and using them, but sometimes it's better to do business with people who you don't actually go out to dinner and be friends with.
I think that may be so. So the other final thing that I think we mentioned, so we mentioned references, down payment, storm chasers, using a friend for a job, and actually having a lawyer review the contract.
Right.
And those
right.
are things you should be thinking about before the job.
Absolutely.
Now, from the homeowner's perspective, during the job, what should the homeowner be thinking about?
Well, I think during the job maybe isn't quite as important as the before. But I would say that during the job, you do kind of want to keep tabs on things that are happening.
Right.
And so if, for example, you've picked out a certain tile, let's say, that your backsplash is, well, then pay attention. Make sure that that's the real tile that you picked out. Or if you've picked out certain cabinets, well, make sure that the contractor's putting in the right cabinets. Otherwise,
right.
you end up with a problem.
Right.
The other thing, again, depending on the scope of the job, if there's going to be payments during the job, then you want to make sure that you're paying for work that's actually being done. And you're also paying proportionately to the amount of work that is being done.
That would be part of the planning phase where you would say, according to our plan, by the time this is done, I owe you this much. And in the next phase, once this is done, I owe you this much. It should be incrementally planned out. Is
yes,
that right?
Yes, absolutely. So you'll want to make sure that once you get that schedule in place that you follow it. You got to stick with it.
What happens if you don't? If you go off there, if you go off track and what happens when there are problems during the job? I mean, say the contractor doesn't meet his completion date or hasn't followed what he said he would follow.
Well, as far as the completion date goes, I mean, I suppose it really depends on how far off
right.
the job is.
Right.
I mean, if we're talking about a number of days, then maybe
no big deal.
Then maybe it's no harm, no foul.
Right.
Everyone's still happy. Everyone's good. But if you're talking about a situation where you're looking at weeks or, you know, hopefully not months, you can run into a really large problem. I spoke with a gentleman the other day who has been in a hotel for months because his contractor, who's building a house for him, didn't get it done on time. And so he's been stuck over at the Hilton, you know, paying a couple hundred dollars per night. And it's all because the job doesn't get done. So if you're talking about that sort of severity, then you have a much larger problem.
At that point, they come to see you.
At that point, you need to get counsel and make your plans from there.
And what would you advise someone when the contractor hasn't been fulfilling their role? You stop making payments for one thing, if hopefully you haven't paid everything up front.
Right, right. Well, if you have a contractor who's not living up to their side of the deal, a lot of what you do depends upon where you're at with the project. And so if it's a problem but not a problem that cannot be overcome. So in other words, if you can get over the problem, if there's a solution that involves keeping the current contractor, that's oftentimes your best bet.
Right. I can see that.
And people don't like to hear that necessarily.
Right, right. They're mad at their contractor. Trust has been breached.
They don't want to work with them anymore.
The project's not coming out the way they envisioned. Their dreams are in jeopardy. Their dreams of a dream kitchen is in jeopardy. They want to throw the contractor off and bring in someone new.
Right.
But they're better off sticking with the devil they know.
Well, a lot of times they really are. And here's why. You bring in someone new, it is going to cost you a whole lot more money than if you could somehow negotiate an end of the first guy. And, you know, the problem is any person coming to a job that's half completed, people in the trades don't really like that situation. They want to pick up a project at the start and take it start to finish. There's not very many guys I know who want to jump into a job that might be already messed up halfway through it. It's just not ideal for them.
Right,
and
right.
And so it makes it harder, frankly, to find someone
just like you
good.
Don't want to take over a case from another lawyer and try and figure out what he's done up to the point where they're handing it off to you.
Right. I mean, right. Me as an attorney, when that happens,
there's all kinds of time bombs. There's all kinds of time bombs in the file that might go off under your watch that you weren't alerted to somehow when you got the handoff.
Yeah, there's definitely increased risk, and like you say, there's time bombs out there that might be waiting for you for sure.
Right. Now, what if the you know, Mark, I want to ask you one more question, but we have to take a break for commercial. But
okay.
When we come back, I want to ask you the question: what happens when the contractor says he's encountered something unusual and it'll be another $5,000 or he can't do it, right? Like, oh,
sure.
I didn't know this was the deal with your plumbing, and because this is your plumbing, I need another $5,000 or I can't do anything. But can we answer that when we come back?
Yeah, let's definitely talk about
Thanks,
that.
Thanks, Mark. Again, this is Bob Monahan, and I just want to thank you again for listening in to Everyday Law. You can reach me anytime on my number at 847-848-6165. Or you can find me on my website at www.monahanfirm.com. Or if you'd like to subscribe to our newsletter, text the word, one word, Everyday Law to 22828. That's Everyday Law to 22828. Again, we thank you so much for listening, and now back to the show. Hi, and we're back with Everyday Law. We're talking tonight about home repairs gone awry. I'm your host, Bob Monahan, and I'm here with my good friend, Mark Van Donselaar, who's an expert with home contracting problems. And before we took the commercial break, I was asking Mark, what about a situation with an unforeseen circumstance where the contractor says, oh, I didn't expect this problem with your plumbing. It'll be another $5,000 to finish this job.
Right. That's always good news, isn't it?
Right.
Well, what I would say, and I know I've said this before this evening, but a lot of it depends on the circumstance.
Okay.
If it's a situation where the plumber, just to use your example, could have discovered that there was this work that needed to be done, and the plumber has gone out and bid the job for a set price, then I think that mistake is on the plumber.
The risk is borne by the plumber.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
If you get a guy out and he bids a job for you, and he doesn't factor in some part of the job that he could have and should have known about, that's the plumber's bad. That's bad bidding. And that's not on the homeowner. Now, you know, if it's something that is completely unforeseen, like you open up a wall, let's say, and no one would have suspected, but such and such is completely wrong. Well, maybe in that instance, it's an additional cost that should be split in half, or maybe split somehow proportionately. But you know, so a lot of that's going to depend on the circumstance. From the homeowner's perspective, probably a good solution to the situation is speaking with the tradesperson and trying to work something out. Because after all, they probably need the work done, and so if it's got to get done, better to talk with the guy who is currently on the job and try and find a solution that gets the work done.
Right, right. Again, that goes back to that issue of, do you really want to start from scratch with someone you don't know?
Absolutely.
Instead of trying to work things out with the guy you do know and take care of the problem and move on.
Absolutely.
Get the thing done.
You can believe that if you bring someone fresh to look at it, he's going to give you the same rate as what the current guy gave you. So that's not a cost savings just to throw off one guy and take on a new one.
Now, we've talked about, is there anything else that should happen during the job from the perspective of the homeowner?
Well, I think that's mostly it. I would just say be vigilant, pay attention to what's going on, be careful with the finances, and I think that mostly covers it.
Okay. Now then, after the job, I think there's certain things that a homeowner needs to be very careful about after the job. Isn't that right?
Well,
or they're facing liens on their property, which no one wants.
Absolutely. And really what you're talking about there when you say at the end of the job is before they give the last dollars. So before a homeowner, or I mean this would apply to really any construction project, commercial, homeowner, whatever, before the last dollars on the job are paid, that owner of the property needs to be assured that the contractor that they have employed has actually paid all the people and all of the suppliers that he used.
Right. Not just subcontractors, but material suppliers.
Absolutely. Especially material suppliers.
Right.
Because there could be, you know, let's just use your $20,000, $25,000
remodel job. Yeah.
There could be three different trades involved. You know, there could be a plumber. There could be an electrician. And then there could be a guy who does the flooring. So, I mean, you very easily have three trades involved in what you might think is a relatively minor project. Additionally, of course, whenever you have new materials put into your project, like cabinets or vanities or tile or things like that, flooring, all of that stuff came from somewhere. Chances are your contractor did not own that stuff when he started your job.
Right.
So he went to a supplier and he bought it. And if he bought it on credit, like a lot of them do, and that's perfectly fine, you can buy it on credit. But if he doesn't pay for it, then that material supplier can look to you for payment.
And I bet a lot of homeowners don't know this.
No, I think it takes a lot of people by surprise because I hear the story. They say, hey, I paid Joe's contracting to do the job. I had no relationship
with the material supplier.
Or the material supplier. They say, I don't know who these people are.
And yet you did. And yet you did have that relationship.
And yet you did in a very indirect way.
You didn't know about it, but you did. So what should the homeowner do to make sure that these suppliers and these subcontractors don't come after him after the fact?
Well, there's a couple they're easy things, but they're often overlooked. I know they are. But what they should start with is before they make that last payment, they should ask their contractor for what's called a sworn contractor statement. And so what that is it's a statement by the contractor that's given under oath. So, you know, it's notarized.
He swears under oath in front of a notary who notarizes it then?
Yep, absolutely. So it has a lot of formality to it. And what it is it's a listing of every subcontractor and every material supplier who has supplied work or materials to the job. And what it
it's a list.
It's a list.
Okay.
It's a fancy list. Uh-huh. But what it does is so it provides the name of those people. It also provides how much those people are owed for what they did for your particular project. And then it also says I said how much their contract was, but also how much they've been paid, how much they remain owed. And so what you want to have is you want to have each subcontractor being paid.
A zero balance for each
subcontractor. A zero balance for each one of them.
And each supplier.
And if there isn't a zero balance, then what you want to do is you can approach it two different ways. You can say to the contractor, well, hey, look, I see here that you owe the plumber $1,000. And so what I'm going to do, I'm going to hold $1,000 back from you, and I'm going to send that directly to the plumber. And then that gets the plumber taken care of, and you won't have any problems with him. The other thing you can do is you can say, okay, I see there's $1,000 owed to the plumber. I need a final waiver of lien from the plumber. If you give that to me, I will give you the $1,000.
I see.
So you can do, you can really go about it either way.
So you can pay the plumber directly if you see the contractor owes the plumber.
Yes.
Or the contractor has to get a waiver to present to you from the plumber that it's okay with the plumber that he'll get paid someday.
Well, and what the waiver says, basically in the second scenario there,
yeah,
what the contractor does is uses his own money to pay the plumber,
right,
and then sort of reimburses himself when you pay
him.
Really, the best way to do it is not that second way. I think the best way is if you see people who have a remaining balance.
Right.
I think the best way to approach it is to hold that back from the contractor and get it directly to those trades.
That's interesting. Now, the threat that you're under, if you're not careful with this, is a lien.
Correct.
And a lien is a claim on your real estate. It's a claim on your home, right?
Right. What we're talking about is a mechanics lien.
A mechanics lien. And I'm not familiar enough with that to go with it, but can you tell me what that is and describe it a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I do a lot of mechanics lien work over the years. And what a mechanics lien really is think of it as a secured interest against real estate.
And again, let's just stop a minute. A secured interest means that secured, it means it's attached to your property.
Right.
The security interest is a money debt, like a mortgage is a secured interest. A mortgage is a debt that's secured by the property, meaning the bank can sell your property to satisfy its debt.
I was going to say, think of it as sort of related to a mortgage. A mortgage is recorded against your house to make sure you pay the promissory note that allowed you to purchase your house.
Right. A security interest. That's a basic everyday security interest.
Yep, secured absolutely. Interest, yeah. So with a mechanics lien, if a plumber or a material supplier or all types of different tradespeople have done work at your property, and if they have not been paid for that work, then they, pursuant to Illinois law, can claim a mechanics lien on your property. And that is their way to try to ensure that they receive payment for the work that they did at your property, and that has, in theory anyway, improved your property. So the procedure for that varies a little bit.
Depending on whether it's materials or subcontractor work?
Well, actually, it depends upon whether it's a general contractor or a subcontractor.
Okay.
So a general contractor, which is anyone who has a contract directly with the owner of the property. So the general contractor simply has to record the lien in the county in which the property is located within 4 months of completing the work. And so that's a fairly simple requirement for the general contractor.
Right.
For a subcontractor, there's more of a two-step process. First off, what they have to do is they have to send notice of their lien against the property. And they have to send that notice within 90 days of completing their work at the property.
Mm-hmm.
And the notice gets sent to the homeowner or the owner of the commercial property, whoever the owner is, regardless of what type of property it is. And it also has to get sent to any bank or other lender that has a mortgage against a property.
Okay.
And then oftentimes, when I do these for subcontractors, I always send it to the general contractor as well.
So you send it to all the parties, really?
So you basically send it out to all the parties who are involved with the project.
And that's the first step. What's the second step?
Second step is then to record in the same way that the general contractor does. And the same timing applies, so 4 months from completing the work.
Now, what this does, we only have about 5 minutes left, Mark, or less than 5 minutes. So, but what a lien does on your property, it means when you sell your property, you have to satisfy that interest, that secured interest, out of the sale proceeds. Is that right?
That's correct, right. And a lien, it does a number of things. It doesn't force you to actually open up your wallet and pay. But the other thing that the lien...
It clouds your title.
It clouds your title. Yeah. So you're right. If you went to refinance your property...
You have a lien on your property.
You have a lien on your property. You need to take care of this. Will be what you hear from a bank or title company. The other thing that can be done is the lien claimant can file a foreclosure lawsuit.
Right. I that would scare the bejesus out of me if...
Well, it puts your property
threat,
at risk.
That
yes.
threat, right? That they can do that. They could foreclose your $100,000 home to satisfy their $1,000 plumbing bill. That doesn't seem possible, but it could happen in the scheme of things. It doesn't happen that much,
no.
I bet, but it could.
It definitely could happen. It's within the realm of possibility.
It is.
It's perfectly allowed.
Wow.
I think in the real world, very few $1,000 mechanics liens get foreclosed.
Because it's expensive to foreclose a lien.
It is expensive. It's a lengthy litigation road to foreclose a lien. And so you have to have more money at stake. But one thing's for certain, a mechanics lien definitely swings the leverage in favor of the lien claimant.
Right.
And that's the best
advice.
Pay
me and I'll take off my lien, but you got to pay me. Right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So the plumber gets paid even though the homeowner already paid the contractor for the job.
Right. Because
the plumber still gets paid because you don't want to lien on your property from the plumber.
Because you don't want to lien on the property. And you're willing to pay twice if it means getting rid of the lien.
Wow. Wow. So you want to get a sworn statement from your contractor that he's paid for all the subcontractors, that he's paid for all the materials. And if he hasn't, you as the homeowner have to take steps to make sure that's done.
Right. The law puts that obligation on you.
On the homeowner.
And actually, you also have an obligation to, before you make that last payment, you are obligated to request that sworn statement from him. And if you don't do that, then basically you go forward at your own peril.
Wow. So it's an affirmative duty of the homeowner to do this. And I bet most homeowners don't know that.
Yeah. It's a forgotten idea. You know, people don't know because it's kind of, you know, it's fairly specialized.
And it is, right?
People aren't doing projects like this every day. It's outside of the
realm. It's not intuitive, that's for sure.
It is not at all intuitive.
It's not something you learn just by working around the house.
Right. And newsflash, the contractor isn't going to tell you it's
and
required
the contractor's
either.
Not going to tell you. He's not going to let you know.
He's going to say, oh, yeah, everything's fine. I got you taken care of here, Bob. And, you know, give me that last check and I'll see you later.
You know, the point of this show is to demystify the law for the ordinary person and to help them understand things that they may not understand and the risks they face that they may not even know they're facing during a job.
And that's a big one in this environment. That's a gigantic
risk.
It's
gigantic. Yeah, Mark, it's been great having you on the show. We didn't get to the perspective of the contractor tonight. We used up our time talking about the homeowner.
Well, we had so much fun with the
homeowner. It was great to talk about the homeowner. We're going to have you on the show again. You've been listening to Everyday Law with me and Mark Van Donselaar. If anyone needs to reach you, Mark, can you tell them the best way to get in touch with you?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm with the offices of Churchill, Quinn, Rickman, and Hamilton, and we're located right in downtown Grays Lake. And our main office number is 847-223-1500. And so you can find me at all hours of all days. And happy to always help out with these sort of problems.
And that's a great Grays Lake firm. I know a lot of guys that work there, and they're really terrific guys. Mark, thanks for being on the show, and now we have to sign out.
Very good. Thanks, Bob.
Again, you've been listening to Everyday Law with me, Robert Monahan. This is the show that demystifies the law for you and your family. You can reach me anytime if you need to at my number, 847-848-6165. Or you can find me on my website and listen to other shows on our blog, and that's at www.monahanfirm.com. And finally, if you'd like to subscribe to our newsletter for more information, you can text the word Everyday Law, that's one word, to 228-28 on your cell phone. Again, text the word Everyday Law to 228-28 on your phone. Thanks so much for listening, and have a great night. We've had a great time together talking about home repairs gone awry.